It would seem that intelligence is the quality needed in a guide, meaning that gentle wisdom which comes by living close to God. It is often discarnate people of the red and yellow races, the Tibetans, Indians, Chinese, Red Indians, who manifest this wisdom of the heart. It has been suggested that the visitor who used to comfort the child Grace when she was alone and frightened was not of this world. He was, in fact, the child's guide or mentor, given this charge from her birth. His name, she learned later, was White Eagle. During all the many years the writer has known White Eagle, he has been extraordinarily reticent about himself, his past and his present mission. He says that he is just a friend to all, an old man who drops in because he likes to help people in their troubles. Maybe he is wiser than some of us because he stands a little higher and can see a little further, and thus knows what is going to happen. Page 15. White Eagle's contact with his medium is always by a process of projection. He lives, we have learned, in the mountains of the East, and he can project either himself or his influence half across the world to her, by functioning, like other initiates, in the ethereal body. So while he lives in a physical body, as do other initiates, he is able, as are they, to function in the ethereal world which pervades this physical globe, of which the latter is the replica. In that ethereal world, the real living world, in which our world of the senses is cradled, there is neither time nor space as we know it. Therefore he need not journey half across the sense world to get anywhere. At once he can be at any one place, or contact any one person, or answer someone's call for help. Only with the resumption of the physical or sense body does the sage resume or take on himself our mortal imitations and our burden. Not even then to the same degree as man. The sage's body is perfected, is no longer subjected to weariness, sickness or death as we know these things. It is a habit of White Eagle's to bestow a new name on his friends, and one which usually seems to fit them better than the name with which they were christened. Sometimes it is the name of a biblical character, such as Peter, Matthew or Luke, or a name from the Pilgrim's Progress. Sometimes it will denote some dominant trait in the personality or stimulate some quality which the personality needs. These soul or character names carry with them, moreover, an inkling of what is to be expected from the person concerned. A Peter, a Luke, or a John will display qualities, shortcomings or virtues, similar to those of their prototypes in the Gospels. Indeed, it often happens that the new name will presently supersede the old one, and a man becomes known by it among his friends. The name which White Eagle bestowed on his medium is Minester, which means mother. We shall see later how apartment this name has been. From now on it will be convenient to refer to the medium, otherwise Mrs. Grace Cook, by the name of Minester. Minester had been conducting services and giving clairvoyance each Sunday, and often on weekdays for about 20 years on behalf of spiritualism. During these years her powers of clairvoyance and vision must have carried conviction to some thousands of people. Thus, the influence of her work had gone far and wide. To contact and to serve the higher intelligence a medium must be a person of unusual and purposefully cultivated sensibility, and with qualities of character, of mind, motive and feeling, without which his or her gifts could never function. This is why so long a period of hard work and endurance was necessary to toughen and at the same time refine her character, even while at the same time her sensitivity was increasing by reason of her work. At the end of these years of what may be called preparation, Minester had reached middle life, and was married with 2 children and a home to look after. By then, however, the nature of her work had changed somewhat in consequence of a meeting with Mrs. Telstead, daughter of the famous journalist, W. T. Stead, who went down in the Titanic, and leader of the Stead Borderland Library, regarded as one of the important centers of the spiritualist movement in London, and where Minester went several times a week. Her task now was mainly to help and convince recently bereaved people of survival. Many of these were torn by grief and sometimes so embittered that it required a great effort to raise them out of despair. The Stead Library was situated in Smith Square, Westminster, and a few hundred yards away in Victoria Street, facing the Abbey, was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's psychic bookshop, which he had opened some years before, aiming not only to supply the general public but animated by the hope that clergy from the Abbey might drop in to purchase psychic books. It is doubtful if any ever did. The bookshop, which was in the charge of his daughter Mary, must have involved Sir Arthur in a very considerable loss for several years. It was not long before such near neighbours as the Stead Library and the bookshop, and also Mynheer Stu and Miss Mary Conan Doyle, became acquainted. A friendship soon sprang up between the two, resulting in an invitation to Mynheer Stu from Sir Arthur and Lady Doyle to visit them at their home near Crowborough in Sussex. Sir Arthur, on hearing about Mynheer Stu's work for spiritualism, and about White Eagle, and especially the latter, was deeply anxious to meet Mynheer Stu. This happened during the summer of 1930 when Sir Arthur was a very sick man. A week-end visit was arranged, and then suddenly cancelled because a turn for the worse came. Soon followed the news of Sir Arthur's passing, a great shock, for he seemed a very part of the Britain of those days. Every one of these seemingly trivial details about Mynheer Stu and Sir Arthur have their significance, for they denote a linking, a drawing together of the two even before his passing. They never met, but they had a community of interests, a likeness of purpose at that time. To the world and to themselves they were as strangers, and yet their lives were interwoven even then by ties destined to draw them closer in the near future. Chapter 4, The Hermit of Bagnaia. If you call me by day or night by these names I will come to assist and to help. The angel will come to assist and help, and the spirits also come. The Avesta. May they who have attained the spiritual life, gentle and righteous, aid us when we call them. Rigveda. The third tributary story which merges into the main current of events is that of the Hermit of Bagnaia, a small town near Viterbo, about 60 miles north of Rome. This account is translated from the Bulletin des Polaires for June 9, 1930. Following many inquiries as to the circumstances which surrounded the transmission of the Oracle de Force Astral by Father Julian to his successor, we have much pleasure in citing briefly where and how this moving episode took place. In 1908 a young man found himself during his vacation at Bagnaia, a pleasant country town of Viterbi in the neighborhood of Rome. No sooner had he arrived than his attention was drawn to an old man wearing the coarse monkish habit. Tall, ascetic, sunburnt, his eyes deep set, he passed along the streets as though in a dream. The lad made inquiries from the country folk. Was this man a godly hermit? No. After listening to what was said, he gathered that this individual, who was called Father Julian, was published from May 9, 1930 onwards by the Groupe des Polaires during their existence in Paris. Although nothing definite in the way of accusation could be brought against him, the presumptions seemed grave. It would be as well, they said, to beware of this strange person, who lived as a wild man of the woods in an old ruined hut and fed on herbs and fruits, who was scorned by all good Christians and was, moreover, one who had never been seen to cross the threshold of the house of God. Things had come to such a pitch that finally it had been pointed out to him, and not too politely, that it might be as well if he did not loiter in passing by the vines or corn fields, for very potent spells, capable of drying up the ripe grapes or of destroying the cattle by a mysterious disease, can be quickly cast. In spite of these tales of magical charms and evil spells, the young man was greatly drawn to the recluse, by a strange sympathy, and one day he decided to visit him in his hut. He was received as one who had been expected for a long time. The lad offered money, clothing, a more suitable shelter. The hermit refused in his curiously deep and slightly guttural voice, a voice, nevertheless, full of great sweetness. He intimated that he found all he required in the woods around him, the herbs and fruits necessary to him as food, the running streams to drink from. Besides, he must stay where he was even in spite of the hostility of those around him, until the day came for him to set out on a long, a very long, journey. The next day the young man paid another visit with eagerness, and never a day passed without a meeting, during which the hermit would speak of goodness, of true love, and of brotherhood. Truly, this young Roman boy, firmly attached though he was to the things of the world, saw in the recluse an initiate and partly understood the gentle foolishness of his self-imposed isolation, his way of life, hard and painful though it appeared outwardly, as well as his firm resolve to refuse all outside aid. The boy was moved by such sympathy and profound pity for the recluse, so good and of such sweetness of nature, that he felt it an almost sacred duty to continue his daily pilgrimage. On going up the path to the hermitess dwelling, he found Father Julian lying unconscious on the road, badly wounded in the knee. He dressed the deep wound as well as he was able, and then assisted the old man to re-enter his hut. The next day he found the hermit up and about. 3 days later the wound was completely healed. What mysterious herbs had been the means of obtaining this complete restoration to health? The young man did not dare to inquire. Many a time the recluse, when questioned somewhat indiscreetly by his young friend, would remain silent, lost in a dream, the reflection of which shone through his large, dark, far-seeing eyes. The link which united the two men grew stronger and stronger. The visits to the hermitess' cell became more frequent, the conversations between them of greater length and of a more intimate nature. The old man spoke meaningly of pain and sacrifice to the younger man, whose eyes were still fixed on the dreams and illusions of life. At length the end of the holidays was at hand. With a saddened heart the youth made his way for the last time to the hermitess' abode. It will never be known what the recluse murmured from mouth to ear to him whom he called for the first time his son. We can only say that at the moment of leave-taking, he handed to him some leaves of paper yellowed by the passage of time. These were a small fragment from the book of the science of life and of death. The recipient of these mysterious pages will remember to the end of his days the last words spoken to him by the sage: "Should you at any time require help or counsel, you have only to follow the instructions which are contained in this old manuscript. You will receive your reply. It may even occur that one day I myself will reply to you. But remember never to divulge to anyone in the world what is written on these pages, for in so doing you run the risk for yourself, as well as for the one who obtains the knowledge, of madness or death." The pages contained an arithmetical system which permitted an answer to whatever question was formulated. The youth, who had little or no inclination to dive into occult mysteries, put away the manuscript in a place of safety, without even having had sufficient curiosity to consult the marvelous oracle. It was not until 2 years later that the young man, who was then in great distress of mind, made use of the strange power which had been confided to him by Father Julian. He consulted the manuscript. It was necessary first to dwell very strongly upon one's wish, to write it down and to supply the surname and Christian name of the one making the inquiry, and also the names of his mother. He formulated his question and then spent long hours in the prescribed arithmetical calculations. The reply obtained showed itself to be astonishingly correct and to contain great wisdom. Amazed at this result, the custodian of the oracle some time later spoke to a group of his friends, who were students of the esoteric, of this strange method of obtaining information. Thus the groups came into being. In 1923 Father Julian kept his promise. He replied himself, in April, 1930, by means of the oracle for Sastral, he sent his last message in the flesh to his well-beloved sons. And now the Lord Buddha has opened to him the path of light. Here the account of how the oracle de force astral came to be used comes to an end. A complete outline of how it worked cannot now be given. This no one knows. The system was communicated, fulfilled its appointed purpose, and has now ceased. It could only be operated apparently by someone possessing the requisite psychic or soul vibration, which perhaps 1 in 10,000 might have, the youth being one of these. Doubtless for this reason he was brought to Father Julian. This is why what follows must seem somewhat sketchy and inadequate. What is quite certain is that the oracle worked and that its message had a cogency and power which made it unique. It was operated, as has been said, by arithmetical calculation. So does the ancient science of astrology operate, although the intuition of the astrologer plays its part. No doubt the intuition of the operator of the force astral was equally important when he was sending or receiving messages. Page 22. God, it is said, geometrizes, for he is the great geometrician of the universe. In other words, the universe of Goddess creation could be reduced to a geometrical or mathematical formula were there any mathematicians capable enough. In a like manner, man's own inventions have to be reduced to formulae before they can be constructed. Much the same principle lay behind the force astral. For instance, any person asking a question through it had to think out the question very clearly and write it down in the fewest possible words. He had also to supply his full name and date of birth, together with his mother's maiden name and her date of birth. The question had then to be translated into Italian, because the force astral operated only in that language. The first task of the operator, now a grown man, and known to his intimates as the magician, was to turn each letter of the words of the question, together with the names of the questioner and his mother, into arithmetical figures. He then, by intricate calculations and by use of his own psychic power, sent out this question and obtained an answer to it, the latter coming in as a mass of figures meaning nothing to the mage until translated back into letters and so into words. From a short question a long answer might come, and vice versa. Sometimes even a long course of instruction or advice would come through. It was claimed that the mind of the operator in no way influenced or affected the quality of the message as might the subconscious mind of a medium. That is as may be. What is certain is that the instructions were accepted without question. It can be imagined how dumbfounded was the young man at this discovery and how eager he and a friend were to communicate again with Father Julian. What they wanted to know now was the why and wherefore of the secret and why it had been entrusted to them in particular. Many hours were spent in communication, which, it is plain, must by reason of the procedure entailed, have necessarily been slow and laborious. A later message through the force astral bade the two men go to Paris and there establish a group which should be called the Polaire Brotherhood. They arrived, strangers in a strange city, and almost penniless. Mysteriously, people introduced themselves and became friends. Money was supplied, and soon the Brotherhood occupied handsome premises in the Avenue Junot on the western slopes of Montmartre. The Bulletin Polaire's, a monthly magazine, ultimately reached a circulation of 10,000 copies among adherents of the Polaire Brotherhood. All this was happening, it should be noted, some few years after the first war which was to end war. At that time the nations were too busy putting their world together again to bother themselves much over the possibility of war in the future. Armed forces were everywhere being disbanded. It is therefore disconcerting to find that the early messages communicated through the force astral referred to the years of fire that were surely coming on the world, if it did not change its ways, and which would involve an era of destruction and privation far exceeding that just experienced. But after these particular communications no more came from Father Julian, who, having as it were established relations, disappeared. Thereafter the communicator was someone carrying greater weight and authority, who became known as the Chevalier Rose, Croix, the Chevalier Sage or the Wise Knight. He has been later identified as the Master Ahu, as it is well known, was once the brother Francis Bacon. The force astral had been entrusted to the young man by way of preparation against the coming of the years of fire. Henceforward the wise knight was to be leader, the force astral his means of communication. A word about the masters. Long ago, an occult tradition tells us, the area of land and sea around the North Pole was not only habitable but possessed of a warm and genial climate. It was referred to by the Greeks as the Hyperborean region, where there had once dwelt advanced men, and, of course, women, known as masters, that is, having become masters over themselves, over their human weaknesses, they were no longer subject to the limitations of time or space as men know them. They were masters of time, and over age, illness and death. While they could live as man lives on the physical plane, they could also lay aside their physical bodies, leaving them in a profound slumber or trance, as do some of the Indian mystics today, and function in unseen worlds such as the after death states. Long, long ago, when the earth was young and innocent, they ruled it by loving kindness. Theirs was the golden age to which folk tales such as the Garden of Eden story refer. But then some interstellar convulsion shifted the earth on its axis, and a tide of ice and snow followed, which slowly enveloped the polar regions, and coincident with this, the golden age chilled and hardened into one of materialism, before whose advance the sages retreated to the mountains of the Far East, where in secluded fastnesses they are established to this day, no longer mingling with the world of men, unable to endure man's present vibrations. Tidings of these masters occasionally reach the peoples of the East, most of whom have heard about and believe in them. Some years ago, the writer met a professor from one of the Indian universities visiting Britain, and in conversation heard him tell of his meeting with a master. When asked what he was like, the professor simply answered, "He is all love." In these words we have the keynote of a master or initiate. Since they no longer mingle with men, their love is now expressed by a projection of light, which is a ray of love, for love takes the form of light when sent out to mankind, and also to certain chosen and responsible individuals, who may or may not be aware of their contact with a master. By this power of projection which they possess, they are able to inspire, to strengthen, to raise such people, if they be willing, but never to influence unduly or override the free will, choice and volition of any human soul. The symbol of the polar star given to the Polares was therefore an ancient symbol descended from Hyperborean times, countless centuries ago, and still possessing some of its ancient power. The oracle therefore astral may date back as long. So also might the method and organization of the Polar Brotherhood itself be modeled on one far in the past. In any case, instructions were given how to make use of the methods of projection employed by the masters, but with a difference, for the Brotherhood groups must perforce work on touch with Lady Conan Doyle, who would then introduce him to the medium through whom the wise knight desired the message to come. This medium, it was stated, had been long chosen and trained for this particular task. When he met her, the Polar Brother would recognize her at once. Let there be no delay. Chapter 5, The Messenger from France. To give religion a foundation of rock instead of quicksand, to remove the legitimate doubts of earnest minds, to make the invisible forces with their moral reactions a real thing, and to reassure human race as to the future which awaits it, surely no more glorious message was ever heralded to mankind. Arthur Conan Doyle, The Wanderings of a Spiritualist. These lines are written on January 27, 1956. 25 years ago, again on January 27, a group consisting of Lady Conan Doyle, her family, and three friends, a Messieurs Ambotiva from Paris, Mines Two and her husband, met at the Stead Library in Smith Square, Westminster. Whether there is any significance in the fact that this account is being written on the same date in January depends on how far numbers influence human lives. For some people become aware that their lives react to numbers in a strange way. For instance, things mostly seem to happen to them on certain days of the week or month. We receive a number at birth, our date and year, and we vibrate to it, each of us being a unit in the mathematical, or geometrical, scheme of the universe. The force astral, for example, was intimately concerned with numbers and depended on arithmetical calculations for its efficacy. Indeed, it operated on a 3, 6, 9 vibration, 9 being thought to be the number of the initiate. The 6-pointed star given to the Polares as their symbol was of course a 6 vibration. This is why the Brotherhood, aware that it must conform to the 3, 6, 9 vibration for its best work, usually chose a 3, 6, 9 day of the month and hour of the day for its principal activities, and at first adopted a diagram depicting the figures 3, 6, 9 as an emblem for the heading of the bulletin Polares. Page 29. Mines Two also was born on the 9th day of the 6th month, and was also a 9th child. Here also we have the 3, 6, 9 vibration evident in her life. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was born on the 22nd May. May is the fifth month of the year, the twos of the 22nd added together make 4, and the 4 coupled with 5 make 9, so here the 3, 6, 9 vibration becomes evident again. It is perhaps worth mentioning that the compiler and editor of this book was also born on May 22nd, because this 365-to-1 chance might have significance. Finally, we note that all the Conan Doyle work and messages began on the 27th day of the month, which is a day of 3, times 3, making 9, and 3 times 9 making 27. The first message from Sir Arthur, whom we will call Arthur Conan Doyle, henceforth for the sake of brevity, came on January 27, 1931, and initiated a long series of messages in which he set forth a full restatement of spiritualism, making it clear once and for all that death and survival, and occasional communication between the worlds, can be regarded as a normal and natural experience, as much part of human life as the love between man and woman or the birth of a child. Those who read his message intelligently and receptively should lose the fear of death. Within a few days of Arthur Conan Doyle's passing, the spiritualists held a memorial service at the Albert Hall to commemorate their leader. Many hundreds were turned away. It would be interesting to know how many of the thousands gathered there to demonstrate their very genuine grief and their reverence for his service to their cause had been convinced of survival by his own mighty effort for spiritualism over the years. They might well have numbered half of those present, so powerful had been Arthur Conan Doyle's advocacy for spiritualism. About this time, many of the leaders of spiritualism met to discuss proposals designed to commemorate Arthur Conan Doyle. S. work for the movement. A million shilling fund was one of these, and nobody saw a limit to what might be accomplished. We shall return to what actually was accomplished later. 10 days after Arthur Conan Doyle's passing, Minesta paid her first visit to his home in Crowborough, where she was welcomed by Lady Conan Doyle and the family. Shortly after a death, the soul of the person concerned can be readily seen by a sensitive or psychic. This was the case with Arthur Conan Doyle, who joined his family in their welcome to Minesta, but was seen by her alone. Incidentally, it must be hard when a man who has passed over seeks desperately to make contact with his relatives, and they shut him out because of prejudice or fear, religious or otherwise. Arthur Conan Doyle spoke to all of them that night through Minesta, not yet himself controlling the medium, but with White Eagle acting as his spokesman. The message was both intimate and detailed. A family reunion took place so strong that none present could doubt or question it. A stranger in these matters may want to know how a dead man can speak to his family. The process is natural enough, but it can only become possible through a close go operation between medium and guide, which comes only after long training and constant practice. It should be explained that communication between White Eagle and his medium takes two forms. Either he may draw very close and bring her under a powerful ray of thought or inspiration, when she will speak the message he desires to send through, or he may bring her under his control, so that she falls into a state resembling the natural sleep of a child. This is by far the stronger, however, being a trance state so deep that she has no knowledge of what is said while it lasts and no recollection afterwards. It is then that White Eagle himself speaks through her. Her voice changes, deepening in tone, and she speaks with a slight accent, a changed delivery and choice of words. Moreover, the mind and personality of the speaker is strongly marked, and there is even a facial change. So complete is the fade out of the personality of Minesta. No one could doubt that it is now one of the opposite sex who speaks. The awakening out of this trance state is as natural as the awakening from sleep. Minesta normally remembers nothing of what has happened. If she shortly afterwards reads a record of what was said through her lips, a faint memory stirs, much like the recollection of a dream during waking hours, and that is all. Page 34. About 10 days later, Minesta was asked to arrange for a special meeting on behalf of Lady Conan Doyle and her family, together with O.M. Zambotiva, who had come from Paris with the sole object of getting into touch with Sir Arthur,